Welcome to the Inside College Soccer Podcast, bringing together some of the best college soccer-related people to your earbuds, from coaches to players and beyond. So, thank you for tuning in. The Inside College Soccer Podcast is brought to you by Sports Recruiting USA, the college soccer experts. Now, enjoy the show.
All right. Hey, Scott, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Don. Appreciate you having me on.
No problem. Always good to, we've been on a roll here talking to national champions. We had Jamie Clark on from Washington men's soccer, and then had Hope Clark on, who you know probably from Daytona State. And then nice to be able to have you on. How's things going in Florida?
Yeah, it's great. Florida itself is great weather-wise in terms of where we're at right now. We actually had a, I guess you could call a cold spell a couple weeks ago where it hit the grand old temperature of, well, for me, it was like -4 degrees Celsius. So what's that, like 28, 25? So when we were training the one morning, the girls had to pull out their thermals, their gloves, their hats, and here's me, the Scottish guy, kind of shorts and t-shirt. And I'm like, okay, maybe I need a hoodie today. You know, and they're looking at you like it's crazy. But I'll say that, you know, 28, 27 degrees in Florida is definitely a lot colder than the temperature 27, 28 when I went to school in Superior, Wisconsin. So that's a cool experience that I didn't think I would get in Florida. But yeah, no, we're loving life down here.
Good. How long have you been there now? This is your second season?
Yeah, second season, so it'll be approaching 2 years in March. So yeah, pretty close to that kind of timeline. So,
all right. And how where were you at before this?
Yeah, so I was before Florida Tech. I was a graduate assistant at Lake Erie College, so in Ohio, D2 school. Did my grad assist there. Really good experience in terms of like hands-on experience, different type of program, different sort of environment. So kind of was able to gain a lot from there. And then, you know, the job at Florida Tech came up and, you know, things worked out the way they worked out, and we're here and we're successful, and we're building something really successful here and hoping to, you know, continue that throughout my time here. So
talk a little bit about being a grad assistant, because I think it's an underrated way for people to get into coaching. I don't feel like it's talked about enough. But I think it's a fantastic way to get into coaching. Tell us a little bit about how that came about and about your experience.
Yeah, so I think I agree with you, Don. Like the grad assist experience is something that really, like, you know, there's two different types of grad assists, right? Ones that go get their degree, they like soccer, and then they go on to full-time employment. Or there's a grad assist with the objective of, okay, I want to learn the experience to get into coaching. And I was definitely, you know, in the latter. So I finished playing in 2022. Knew that kind of coaching had always been part of my life. From when I was in high school, I coached. In my gap year, I coached. So kind of, you know, wanted to experience that in the college level. Applied for a couple of positions, you know, speaking to people, wanted to be in the right fit, wanted to be, you know, in a certain part of the country. And, you know, landed at Lake Erie College. And the setup there was really cool in the terms of, there was a head coach, full-time assistant, graduate assistant. Then, you know, the men's soccer side was similar. And we kind of all shared this like hub of an office. Like the head coaches had their own office, and then the grad assistant, the assistants and softball assistants were in the same space as well. So a lot of like really good learning and engaging, because you're bouncing ideas off each other, or you're hearing how sessions are being planned, or you're hearing about what's going on from that aspect as well. And then I guess for me personally, like a really, you know, a difficult moment with it, but also at the same time, now I look back on it, it was a brilliant experience. Was after the first couple months at Lake Erie, the head coach and the assistant coach both left towards, it was probably in the first couple weeks in December. So it was kind of on me to run the program. And I ran the program as the interim head coach for 3 months, you know. So in terms of really learning the nuts and bolts of college soccer, I think as all athletes, honestly, you're quite good at a sport as a player. You always think like, oh, I can coach. Yeah, no problem. But the actual coaching side of it is, especially at the college level, is barely 20% of your time, you know? So I think that it put me in a difficult spot in terms of being a young coach, but also like the stuff that I learned and waking up every morning and still like loving going to work, knowing that it was going to be difficult. You know, grad assist, you get your degree, but you don't barely make enough to survive. But you're also knowing at the same time, like you're getting a degree, a master's degree. I got my master's degree in business administration with a healthcare concentration. So like knowing that like that was also a part of it, but then that's also a part that, you know, I had to balance that doing three classes a semester. As an international student, you can't do it online. So you've got to be, you know, in person. So that takes part of it. But yeah, really, really cool experience. Again, like I said, kind of thrown in at the deep end, really taught me that like, yes, I love this. I love the game, but I also love like the personal side of it, the building relationships with the players. That year we had a turnover of like 16 players, a lot of seniors with a lot of impact. So like we had to bring a big class in. And the AD, Molly Hoffman, she was unbelievable with me. She basically gave me the keys and said, run it. If you're going to do anything big, let me know. But I trust that you're going to make the right decision. So, you know, recruiting players internationally, recruit players in state, out of state. Like, again, another that experience that I was really fortunate to get. And at the time was maybe a little bit daunting. But now, if you ask me now, it's like, you know, that's up there. One of the best things that happened to me was getting that raw experience thrown at the deep end. And it's kind of like, hey, how long can you float this boat? And I think I did a pretty good job of it. So.
How'd you end up hooking up with connecting with Katie?
Yeah, so we had no prior connections. I didn't know anybody that knew her. I was aware of kind of like her position within the program. You know, so when I was at Lake Erie, you obviously follow the tournament. You follow where they'd gone. They had a 5-4 game against Lenoir Ryan in the Elite Eight, where they're 4-0 up at halftime. Then you see that it goes to 4-all, and then you see it's 5-4. So we're at ECNL Florida in the January after that, and we sat next to the then assistant coach Brooke, and we're kind of like, wow, like that was awesome. Like you guys did that, made it to the Final Four. You know, obviously lost to Point Loma in the Final Four. So then that existed. So you're just kind of like aware. And then I remember being in the office, and Bex, the then head coach at Lake Erie, was like, oh, Florida Tech head coach has left, gone to Jacksonville. They've hired their volunteer assistant. And you're kind of like, oh, like that's interesting. You know, then you delve into it, you Google Katie's name, and you're like, oh, like Katie's legit. Like she's a baller, you know, youth national team stuff, Auburn stats, NWSL draft, like all that stuff. So yeah, we had no prior connections, no nothing, you know, just applied for the job and got on the phone with her. And I think that first phone call was like, you know, I think we connected both from like a holistic standpoint, but also how we view people, how we view players, how we view life. And I think that's something where, you know, I back myself in situations to where my resume is not going to stand out from like a soccer standpoint in terms of a career, in terms of like my coaching. You know, I was at a program that won 6 games in 2 years, you know, so I think knowing when I had the opportunity to talk her on the phone, you know, I was super grateful that she even, you know, called me back. I had calls for or applied for jobs with teams in our conference in our region and didn't even get anything back. You know, so you're kind of like in that boat of like, okay, how am I gonna kind of go about this? And yeah, the minute I got on the phone and we connected and just we see the game so well, but we also see things completely different that we balance it. So I see it as a privilege to be able to work with her and, you know, just learn from her from her experiences. We were in the office last fall and like she's like, oh, I've got to take a call at Sam Kerr. And I'm like Sam Kerr, like, and she's like, yeah, like we played together and stuff like that. So like being in like learning from that environment, because it wasn't an environment that I was good enough to get into, but like seeing how she just, you know, operates and stuff like that, I think we're very lucky to be there and learn from her as well.
Yeah, that's something that you must appreciate from her because I think some coaches, especially younger coaches, you know, that want somebody who thinks like them. And I think what you said there is so important to have a coaching staff that isn't, you know, everybody agreeing all the time or having the same perspective all the time. Not that you want it to be adversarial at all. Not what I'm saying, but to have people that bring something different to the table, I think balances out the coaching staff a little better.
Yeah, it's so important too, because like we're both young coaches and kind of our journeys and stuff. So I think having, you know, it's easy to be a yes person at times, and sometimes like, you know, that exists. You know, whether we like fully agree on things all the time in terms of how it wants to be played, like I think that can't always be the case. Like, so she was a number 10, she's forward minded. She'd rather win a game 5-4. I was a defender, center back. Like, no, I want to win 1-0. You know what I mean? So it's like having that
Right.
balance. So, you know, when we play games, like those things come up. But I think like we're so aligned in how the game's played from an individual standpoint and a team standpoint that like we balance each other out. So like, you know, you think of like the connotations, like if we're winning 2-0, it's like in my head, it's like, okay, the next goal is the most important one because if it goes 2-1, you know, like that traditional, like probably like British mentality of a thing exists. Where in her head, she's like, no, the next goal means we're going to win 3-0. You know, and if it, that type of thing, I think balances it well. But also, like her being an attacker, like helps me coach better as a defender because I get real insight from her, like when she played and how she had to play things and how she had to do things. And then also, I would say like vice versa. You know, as a defender, like how we impact what forwards do and how we see things in different perspectives. I think, you know, it's a good balance, and you know, we learn a lot from one another from both the soccer standpoint, life standpoint, and even just like NCAA modules and rules and stuff like that, because we are still new to it. So we're having to be sponges with people in the department to kind of make sure that we're in align with everything that we need to do and things like that.
What are some of the challenges that you've noticed for you coaching women? Obviously, you're a male player, always involved in the male side of the game, just worrying about yourself, but now having to make that transition over the last couple of years into coaching women. I know my very first year, the head coach came to me as an assistant on the women's side and said, the girls hate you. They want you gone, but I'm going to stick by you, and I'm going to try to help you through this, figure it out. And it took me a while to make the transition from thinking like a man thinks in the men's game, which was, for me, and especially in my day, it was take no prisoners. It was a war. It was every man for himself. It was I was worrying. I could speak to the men differently than I could speak to the women. But for you personally, what are some of the challenges that you've noticed?
Yeah, there's absolutely been like little challenges and little like learning moments and growth moments throughout that time. So I think if you'd asked me, if you told me at 16 years old, 17 years old, when I was kind of like, you know, having my own teams with clubs back home, that like you're gonna coach women or, you know, young females, I would have been like, no, like that doesn't exist. Like growing up in Scotland, obviously the game's progressed since my time in the US, and that's been great to see. But I would have been like, no, of course I'm not. You know, I was involved with my club's first team at the age of 16. So like you're in that environment, thrown in the deep end, like you see how things run. But I've definitely been fortunate enough to all the actual head coaches I've worked for have been females. And they've all, you know, helped me learn and have that relationship. I go back to like a personal thing too. Like my younger sister's 4 years younger than me. So when I started as a GA at 22, she's 18. You know, my sister and I are very, very close. We talk all the time about life, about sports, about what she does for her career. You know, she's involved in the sports field. So like I think to be able to like know that I can communicate with someone in that age and also still be like relatable to them has been really, really helpful. You know, I think my sister and I have a great relationship where we have tough conversations. Same thing as a coach, right? Like you have to have tough conversations at times, but they know it comes from a place of care. So I think, you know, really learning and focusing on building those relationships in terms of, you know, that if we have a tough conversation, let's say it's about playing time, like we want to be direct. That's the best way we feel to do it. But you can't be direct if you don't have a bit of humility and know that person, right? So it's like working in that aspect. You know, if I was to compare men's to women's, like it's completely different. But at the same time, there are positives that you can take from being in those environments to seeing how it's portrayed, right? Like we had a meeting with our leadership group this morning, just kind of about like, you know, the authenticity of how we want to deliver things. And I'm, you know, they're asking us as about our experiences. And it's like, well, if I was to act the way I acted as a player and as a captain when I was in college and with a group of females, like it probably isn't perceived that way. But that's just like the nature of things. So it's like, but as a coach, like I see it from my standpoint and how I looked and viewed things. But now I see it from their standpoint. I'm like, okay, like what is needed and what is done. And then again, like I said, young coach, so I'm still figuring things out. But definitely I think the relationship side's huge, but also I've had really positive, strong female leaders that I've learned from and been able to kind of like grasp things from and kind of move forward that way. So yeah, it's definitely, I always like think back about that. Like if you'd asked 16-year-old Scott, like, are you gonna, you know, you're gonna coach, but you're gonna coach females. I would have been, you know, in Scotland 10 years ago, that that wasn't a thing. Like the girls' teams have ranging ages, you know, back when it was, I actually, one girl I played with growing up, she was the best player on our team. But then I didn't play with another girl basically ever, you know. So I think like culturally, like that's been a huge change, which has been awesome to see also from like, you know, just seeing it from the out, and it hates me to say it, but like England being very successful on the women's side has been brilliant for it. But you know, hopefully Scotland can build on it as well. But yeah, no, that's definitely kind of how I would say those challenges have arose and kind of dealt with them. So, but definitely still learning, definitely still learning.
Yeah, it's interesting as you talk about growing up in Scotland because I've traveled all over the world. I've been to South America and Europe and recruiting, looking at it, and a lot of countries have not treated taken the women's game seriously at all. When we were in Argentina, even seven aside pitches, if the men wanted to play, the women had to walk off the pitch and allow the men to play, even if it was in the middle of them playing. It just wasn't serious. And when I was recruiting overseas, they would ask, do you coach, where do you coach? And when I told them I coach women, I got the answer, why would you do that? It just not taken seriously. But it's changed. It's slowly changing. I think the United States, through law, through Title IX, has helped a lot. And then, winning multiple World Cups, so other countries started taking it more seriously because they didn't want to get beaten. And I love the fact that it is changing, that Spain's doing so well now, and England's doing better. And it's like you said, Scotland's taking it a little more seriously now, and Germany's taking it. So you get these countries that are taking it more seriously, and it's I think it's good for the women's game worldwide.
Yeah, 100%. And I think you've touched on that piece. I was lucky enough in my gap year that I worked with a sports tours company where we took, you know, teams from the US, still brought them over to Europe, and we worked with pro academies and done stuff. And we took Cal Berkeley in 2017 over to Barcelona and Rome, and we played at Juan Gamper against Barcelona. We played against Espanyol, we played Roma. And one of the biggest takeaways I had from after the game was, you know, this is the where we played Roma's first team, and they won 2-1. And there's, you know, players at the time were in the Italian national team or kind of in the pool, and they were asking the Cal girls like, "Hey, can I have your shirt after the game? Can I have your shorts after the game? Like, can I have your socks?" Because like the Roma girls just had men's hand-me-downs, you know, like that existed 10 years ago, you know. And I think like that, to see the way it's kind of changed and grown, and the growth of the women's Super League in England has been phenomenal. And I think it's only gonna get better and give players options to go and play afterwards. You know, we've got a lot of players here at Tech, both, you know, US based and or US, you know, US citizens and international players that want to go and play, and maybe beforehand they were kind of like hamstrung with where they could and go and play at a good level. And the fact that now they're getting more opportunities, you know, both in the US and in Europe and in South America and in Australia and stuff. So I think it's been great to see that growth, because again, as a program, like, we want to provide those opportunities for players, because we have players that have that ability to go and be successful and make careers for themselves after college.
You had mentioned earlier that you guys had just met with your leadership group. I've noticed this is a trend that's been occurring, especially in the women's side, but I think it's starting to happen on the men's side too. In the old days, we had a captain. Coach would say, "You're the captain." That was it. End of discussion. And what being a captain meant was different to every team and to every coach. But you mentioned a leadership group. Tell us, I want to hear a little bit about the leadership group and how that works, how the group is selected, what types of things that they do, what roles do they have, what responsibilities do they have.
Yeah, so I think one thing again that we have that we're fortunate was it's very player led. So we have our lead. If I go back to our leadership group in the fall, it was a lot of senior players that had been in the program. We had a couple of players that had been in the program 4 or 5 years, had kind of seen the growth and seen the personal development of it. And those players, you know, are graduating now. So we have a lot of emphasis on, you know, they did a fantastic job for us. Unbelievable people, unbelievable players, unbelievable leaders, like led help us, you know, get to where we got to. And we've as a staff of kind of see, you know, it's big shoes to fill, but they also shouldn't be intimidated by it. I think the biggest thing that we spoke about today was just the authenticity of their leadership. You know, not everyone's going to be the leader. You know, when you talk about leadership, people think it's the loudest person or it's the person that's has the most tangible contributions in a game or that type of thing. So I think it's just talking about like as a group, like what does the team need? What do you guys need to go and be successful? And I think a lot of it, again, through our due diligence in terms of recruiting and also putting players in those positions, that we get a good job in letting it be very player run. You know, again, we're there for support, we're there for advice, but at the same time, like we want you guys to make the decisions. We also are okay with you guys making mistakes because that's where you're going to learn. We have a very young leadership group right now, in terms of just that's the way our classes and our team's going to be next year. So I think it's also empowering them to know that, okay, like our previous leadership team were this, but you're also your own independent people. We don't need you to be the leaders that were here before. There's no right or wrong way. But the right way is for you to be organic and kind of go through it. And, you know, the way we kind of pick it is we offer it like we kind of do. We do a team meeting at the start of the spring, just kind of like touch bases on it. We have the girls participate in it, kind of get a feel for it. Usually, I would say 9 times out of 10, they're the names that we're thinking of anyway, because it's, you know, you see it happen. And then, you know, Katie and I, we talk about it, and then the group is just put together. Today was one of the first like meetings we've had as a group, and just kind of like again, just establishing what they want, what they're seeing, because those are they're an extension of us, right? They're extensions of how we want to do things. We have a lot of trust in our leadership. Being a leader, you know, it's a good thing, but it also is a difficult thing, right? Your life becomes a little more difficult when you become a leader because you've got the eyes and the expectations on you, but also knowing that again, we don't need you to be someone that you're not is, I think, a big way that we want to do things because people can lead, you know, verbally, they can lead with their standards, they can learn lead with their integrity, they can lead with their pure playing ability, you know, and it's kind of like getting the mesh together of that group is important. So this spring we've got 7 players in the leadership group. So it's a good number, kind of moving forward. And again, a lot of them are kind of in that sophomore junior class, to go and build and basically an opportunity for them to learn and ask questions. And again, an opportunity for Katie and I to learn and kind of help us grow as coaches to see how we can help continue making this program successful.
So is it is your leadership group, is it of those 7 players, are you guys trying to make sure that every class is represented, or is it just the best leaders available?
I think a bit of both. Every class is represented, but I also think it's ones where, again, it comes to the authenticity of it. Like some people we would have conversations with, and it's like, you're a real leader, you know, at the end of the fall or in meetings during the fall. And they're like, really? I'm not loud. I'm not this. I'm not that. I think it's just players that have the opportunity to grow and develop. You know, I think we don't want to put the pressure on our freshmen in that group right now, but we see it as a valuable experience for them being involved to grow and to learn. Like I said, we've been very lucky in the past couple of years and even before I got here that the leadership and the culture was great in terms of how they did everything. But it's also allowing them, the new players in those roles that are here now, this is going to be their program for, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 years, that, you know, you can kind of build it in a way that suits our team. Every team's different. That's like the beauty of college soccer. Like 1 year you're this, the next year you know, we in terms of players that graduate, the dynamic can change. And that doesn't necessarily have to be a bad thing moving forward. So yeah, every class is represented, but I wouldn't say it's just like we're putting them there for the sake of putting them there. We see it as an opportunity for them to grow and develop. And, you know, they've got characteristics in how they play and how they handle themselves that we think are beneficial to the overall group. So
And what are the roles and responsibilities of the group?
they, like I said, we're very player led in terms of how they do things. So they have a lot of humility in how they do things, so they do their own laundry as a group, as a team. So you know, that's something we came in and we're like, okay, like we've got the laundry room on campus, how do we want to do things? Leadership like, no, we take care of it, you know. So they do their tasks for practice, you know what I mean? So it's like, well, who's on? If someone's on laundry, that's decided by them. If someone's on gear, that's decided by them. If we have a recruit on campus, and they want to, you know, they're starting a visit or we're gonna have a dorm tour, it's like, okay, like leadership, like are you guys around, like what's going on, how can we involve you guys in it? And then just a sounding board for us as coaches, you know, getting a feel for, you know, it's the spring, we're working hard right now, like they're getting a lot of miles put under their belt, you know, leaning on them, being like, hey, how are the girls feeling, how's the group feeling, how's the intensity, how's the environment? Like again, they're an extension of us, and the trust that we have in them and the leaders that we've had in the past has been very, very good. And it's kind of allowed us, you know, to be successful. So like, I think if when if I take us back to the Final Four, we're all in Colorado where finals are going on. People are stressed, you know, and would they have a good feel of what's going on? So it's like, okay, do you think the girls need, well, you know, what do you think we need? We're on the outside looking in. We're trying to plan for to play against a team that we've never played before. So we're up to our eyes in film and admin work and all
Right.
this. And it's like, hey, what do you guys need right now? This is what we're feeling, but like we trust what you're going to say and what is going to be the best for the team. That, you know, okay, we actually think that going for this training session today, it probably needs to be lighter in terms of like the environment. But at the same time,
Right.
I think we need to have the ball down. We need to play. Great, perfect. That like helps us make our decision. Because again, our job is to put the girls in the best possible spot to be successful on the field, off the field. Why wouldn't we use them and allow them to feel that like that leadership role, but also having them, you know, not feel entitled in any way, but they're doing it for the benefit of the team and not just benefit of themselves. So.
And is that the feedback that they're bringing to the coaching staff from the team? Is that through a formal or an informal process that the leadership group has with the team?
I would say both. I would say a little bit of both. We don't like lean on them for, you know, it's not like we're like, oh, hey, what happened this weekend or what's people doing here? You know, it's nothing along those lines. It's more
Right.
so, you know, the feeling within the group. Like, so this morning we ran 44 yard repeated sprints, you know, so we know that's difficult. We know that's tough. They have the weekend off. But I think if that was on like a Tuesday, you know, how are the girls? You know, we have futsal on Wednesdays. So it's kind of like if we were to do that on Tuesday, it'd be like, hey, girls, like, what do you think we're doing? You've done brilliantly in the conditioning to start. We're approaching our, you know, 45-day window soon. We want to start like building bigger to be able to play to prepare for spring games. But like, what's your thoughts on it? Do you think we can keep pushing you guys? Obviously, we have our idea and our kind of like decision is final. But I think to re we respect their opinion. We respect them as people and individuals that, you know, yes, we want to have inputs. Again, it's player-led and kind of how we want to do things. We just, as coaches, we're there to facilitate. We facilitate the program right now. It's their program. You know, the coaches we just facilitate. We're here in the now, but it's their program and kind of their legacy that they look back on. They're the athletes of the program. So I think using them as a tool and in our toolkit is absolutely very, very useful.
You talked about the pressure of the Final Four, and obviously some of the players had been there last year or the year before, right? And then this year going in, what did the staff do to prepare the players to deal with the pressures of making a run at a national title? Was there
Yeah.
any different preparation, or was it just, hey, this is business as normal, just another game, let's just do what we've been doing all year long? Or was there any different preparation going into that Final Four?
So I think naturally the way it transpired and it being in Colorado and it having to fly and having to play, we played Lenoir Rhyne on the Saturday night and then flew out on the Monday, you know, like that in itself made that feel different and special. I think also we did acknowledge that it was going to be different. I think it's such a big game that like it would do a disservice to not acknowledge it. But at the same time, like everything was, you know, I don't think we did anything out of the ordinary in terms of like what we would do if we were playing Rollins at home in an SSE game, you know? So that's kind of something that we let it be what it was. But we just continued how we did things. I think from a coaching standpoint, both Katie and I, like I mentioned earlier, like Cal Poly Pomona, we hadn't come across them before. Obviously, we knew they were a good team. They were ranked all year, good players with a lot of ability. So, like, you know, in terms of the due diligence, we did a lot of it. We do a lot of film and a lot of scout with the team. So we want to kind of leave like no stone unturned with that. But I don't think we had to go, you know, different approach, different style with it. It was still a game, but also acknowledging that like, hey, you guys have done phenomenally well to get here. This is where we're at. But at the end of the day, you peel back all the shiny smoke bombs and fire stuff when they're walking out and the cool stadium and the plane and we're in Colorado. Like, it is just a game. You guys have been playing this game for 20 years, 18 years. Like, that's how we do it. And I think too, like the kind of the progression of our season allowed us to really do that. I think if we look at like the differences from the start of the year to the end of the year, you know, a lot of people have been on the road a lot this past couple of weeks, and you know, coaches are like, you know, like, what did you guys do different? And I was like, I don't really think we did much different. I think a couple of times at the start of the year, the ball maybe didn't bounce for us, and then towards the end of the year, it was bouncing for us, you know, and you kind of create that that momentum yourself. I think if we'd kept playing, you know, if there was more games after the final, I think whoever we would have faced, we would have won because we were just in that momentum. You're in that phase, like everyone's kind of, they're hooked in, they're bought in. It's things are working, things are bouncing the right way. Like Caitlin's making saves and goals that she has no right making, and it's like, okay, but that's now normal. You know, we know she's going to do that. We know she's going to execute. So, like yeah, and like I said, making it what it was, but also not being lost in that like difference and stuff, and that they'd worked hard and deserved to be where they were at that day.
Yeah, no, that's fair. And I think especially because you guys had some really tight games, and I think every game was a one goal game up until the final. And you get to the your players do get to that, and the staff gets to a point when you have that where it's like, oh, we're unbeatable. We're not going to lose no matter what. It just this feeling. I've had been lucky enough to have one or two teams in my life where you could be down 2-0 and it really didn't matter. There was no panic at any point, and a team comes back and wins 3-2, and it's like, yeah, well, of course we were. There's no
Yeah.
doubt.
Yeah, Ben, we'd had little moments like that throughout the year. Like I said, like we weren't playing bad at the start of the year. It just some things weren't going the way it was going. And then, you know, we're 2-0 down to Rollins at the start of the conference with 5 minutes to go, and we score three goals in 5 minutes and win 3-2. You know, and Rollins for
Right.
our conference, like Rollins is such a tough place to go. It's well, you know, you go in, you win, you kind of like perfect. You know what I mean? Like that's all you can expect. Just the environment, the atmosphere, the type of pitch it is, the setting, like they're a tough team to play, home or away. But like going to Rollins is one you circle on the calendar. You're like, in my like for me, like that's our Stoke away on a Tuesday night. Going to Rollins, you go in, it's going to be difficult. They're going to run, they're going to be physical, they're going to have players in good positions to score. And it's like we're 2-0 down with 5, 6 minutes to go, and you're going, we're still in this. And then we score three fantastic goals. One's a direct free kick, one's from 35 yards, and one's like a I compared to like Van Persie when he played Man United, or Peter Crouch for Stoke against whoever it was, where the ball was played at the top corner of the box and he just hits it first time over his body into the far corner. Like three very, very good goals. And you're like, did we deserve that? On the base of play, no. But at the same time, we did deserve it because of the team and how special we were. And we were able to do those moments, and people didn't give up. You know, 2 minute, 2-0 down with 5 minutes to go, like no one has any right to win that game, right? We don't have any right to win that game. But the type of people that we have in the program, from leadership to impact players to starters to players that were injured and impacting that game, like yes, like that was a good moment. And again, you could probably look at that as maybe like a shifting moment in our like psyche of like, okay, like even when it feels tough, even when it feels like it's not going to go our way, we have the players in the room that can make those special moments happen.
Yeah, that's interesting that you put it that way about not deserving it but deserving it. Because I've always said the mark of a championship team is, when you're better than another team, you just get the job done, and it doesn't feel like there's any pressure on the day. It just like we took care of business, and then when you're equal to the other team, you just always figure out a way to beat them. It's just like we're equal. And then when you've got those games and those days where they're better than you, they've just got you. You figure out some way to pull it out. Somehow you just always get it done. Like you said, three goals in 5 minutes is crazy. But you figure out a way to do it. And that's the mark, that's the mark of a championship team. It's those years, Scott, where it goes the other way. It's like, we were the better team today, and we just can't figure out a way to win. That as a coach, you just know. Yeah, there's no way we're winning a national championship like this,
Yeah, and we had
I think
similar
the players
experiences.
stop believing at some point.
Yeah, absolutely. And I couldn't agree more with that piece. Like we go back to our first year here. You know, we swept conference, we won conference, we finished first in the conference, we won the conference tournament. Like, but then we get beat by Montevallo in the second round of the NCAAs. You know, we got a bye in the first round and we got beat in the first round by Montevallo. And you ask anybody that was there, we talked to Montevallo coaches even when we see them this year, like, well, like we were the better team in terms of like how we did things, but they scored on their third shot on goal in the whole game and they won 1-0. And you're like, yeah, like they deserve that. Like that's how it works. And you know, you get those moments where, and I think that the way that season ended was probably again another bit of hunger that we had from our group and was driven by the leadership of, okay, guys, like Yes, we won two trophies last year, the first time in program history that's ever happened, but like we're hungry for more. We've got that drive. So when you're in the spring and you're running and it's more difficult, you go back to those moments where you're like, okay, like this is all great. We do all this, but like again, like that's why like football is just such a good game, right? Like it's on paper, you can never like it's never the best team's gonna win or the best team's like gonna set it out how it's gonna be. Like Montevallo absolutely did a number on us that day. And again, I think it's those experiences put together with other ones that we had allowed us to be successful this year and throughout the year as a whole.
Yeah, how did you end up coming over here to the United States in the first place?
Yeah, so this is a cool story in terms of I'll probably go long-winded on it because I think there's a lot of like important little like nuances in it. So growing up was playing for a club called AM Soccer. So one of like the best like non-professional academies in Scotland. So the owner is Austin McPhee. So he's the assistant coach now at Aston Villa. He was a set piece coach for Scotland. He's now the assistant coach for Portugal, like the men's national team and stuff. So I had a lot of really cool opportunities through that club. I came to the US when I was 12 years old and played in Texas at the Eclipse Soccer Club in Dallas. So kind of got to see facilities and stuff like that. Again, really young, but like, you know, you see it and it's cool. And you go to NASA and you go to Houston Dynamo and you see all that stuff. So that was cool. Was in and out of kind of like we had these like pro youth academy things with the club where like we had connections with whether it was Dundee United, whether it was Fife Elite, whether it was Raith Rovers, whether it was Dunfermline, like, and I was kind of like always that player that was on the periphery of it where they were probably looking at me going, maybe, maybe not. You know, that type, those players in my team that were getting picked and coming back or getting picked and staying. So was kind of in that like area. And then Austin, the founder, he played at UNC Wilmington for 3 years. So it was kind of like as we approached that, my finishing up high school, knew that, you know, he kind of spoke to me, but this could be a really good opportunity for you. But I ended up staying home for a year and working, like I was saying, for the sports tours company. And kind of getting that experience, you know, working with Cal Berkeley. We did a little bit of work with Vanderbilt as well, worked with Christopher Newport University. So kind of getting to see the college environment was really, really cool and unique. And working with, you know, really good professional clubs, like I was saying, we're in at Wangamper doing sessions, learning from the coaches, Espanyol, Roma, Chelsea, Arsenal, like all those really cool experiences and like
Right.
seeing that really like opened my eyes. And then thankfully, you know, having Austin as a reference, I was just sending out emails to coaches kind of pretty naively. You know what I mean? I think looking back now, there's things I would have done differently. You know, the whole piece of it, you know, like if I was to talk to myself now, it'd be like, you know, you need to email more junior college coaches because that is an experience for that I think would have been valuable for me. But again, everything's going to happen the way it's meant to happen and it didn't happen that way. So just send out emails, Austin as a reference. So I'd got in touch with the Gannon University coaches. So Dale White, he was the head coach at the time. He's Scottish. So he was doing one of his UEFA licenses in Scotland, which Austin was either, I can't remember if he was running it or was one of like supporting staff on it. So he, you know, put two and two together and kind of spoke to Austin and, you know, connected with myself. And then, yeah, before I knew it, I was boarding a plane to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, out of Scotland as an 18 or 19-year-old at the time. So slightly different, you know, route in terms of how I did things. Again, I think if I'd had a little bit more education on it, I probably would have made different decisions. But, you know, looking back on it now, where I am today, like it shaped who I am in my journey. So, yeah, really like cool and unique experience off that. And kind of been in the US ever since. So,
Did you notice any differences between how the football was played in Scotland compared to where you were in college when you came to the United States? Or were there any other surprises for you that took adjustments? Was there
I
an
would,
adjustment period?
yeah, I definitely had probably a bit of arrogance about the level. You know, I was like for my club back home, we had like a men's first team, a men's reserve team. I was kind of in with them from like the age of 16, you know, kind of like learning through them and playing in those environments and playing for them. So I'd never seen a weight room. My weight room was playing right back against a 34-year-old left winger that had played, you know, 500 games in the second division in Scotland. You know, like that was kind of like my adjustment stuff. So that was a big thing. That I struggled with the physical side of it. And then I was definitely thought that I would be a better, you know, or the level wouldn't be as high as what it was, you know. So I came across and I
That's
was
really common, Scott. That
yeah.
I've coached hundreds of international players over my career, and that's probably the number one comment that I get is this is much better than I thought it was going to be, and
Yeah, and
much
I think,
harder.
and it doesn't get, it doesn't get the credit it deserved. I think at Gannon we had a good mesh of, again, international guys and American guys, but also, we play in the PSAC, so you do have, you have at the time you had Mercyhurst, you had Slippery Rock, so international teams, but then you'd play against Westchester, you play against Millersville, who are all American players, so you got the real like different sides of it, and not one way wasn't better than the other, and kind of learning that, I think like the physical side was massive. I remember kind of being in sessions and being like I feel good, I'm involved, I'm playing, I'm on the ball, and then we get to the physical side of it, I'm like, this is just different. And then back home I was never someone that was at the far end of running, I was never the fittest guy, but I definitely was in the top percentile, and then I'm going here and I'm like, how are you guys, like this is insane, and then you talk to them and they're like, yeah, like I've been in the weight room since I was 12 years old, and I'm like, I have never seen a weight room or know what a barbell is, and you're just kind of like, you're in the college level with how quick and how fast it is, like your feet can get you so far, but you've got to be able to cope with that physicality side of it. So definitely like a massive learning experience. And again, it's something I've taken into coaching as well. Like I learned how to do the little things very, very well. Like I was never going to be the quickest, never going to be the strongest, but it's like, okay, like how can I like treat my body well to help me like differentiate the gaps and stuff. So I think as a coach, like I've learned that as well. Like we talk to players, if you're a defender, like, are you going to be the best, passer of the ball? Maybe, maybe not. But what are you doing to kind of like supplement that that's in your control? So yeah, definitely like a cool experience. And yeah, the level was good and higher than I anticipated. And again, that made me a better player, made me have to kind of like commit to it and kind of, commit to the process and commit to that development process as well, which I think is slowly getting lost in the college game in terms of the developing. I didn't play, I was like ineligible my first year, and I think nowadays, like a lot of players, their focus would have shifted. Whereas for mine, it was like, oh, wow, I got a knuckle down now. Like I've lost a year. I wasn't able to play. Like I've got a lot of work to do to kind of like get back to where I wanted to go.
Why were you ineligible the first year?
That's a great question. I've actually never got the full answer to that. I've never got the specific one. The compliance officers just couldn't find it. If you were to ask me, my educated guess was I filled out eligibility center stuff incorrectly in terms of like minutes played and that type of thing. I was playing for two teams at the same, like I was saying, I was playing for the first team. If I wasn't on the, if I didn't make the squad for the first team, I was playing for the second team. Then I was playing for the U19s on the Sunday, like that type of thing. So I think that's, again, if I was more educated in how to do the processes, then I would have done something differently. So again, that was, and wasn't something. It was kind of something where I remember submitting it and being like, okay, like this will be tight. We don't know if you'll be able to participate, in training the first couple of days. And then it's just something that never got like fully, you asked me there. I couldn't tell you the precise answer. I think as I've grown as a coach and kind of understood things from the other side of it, I think that's the reason why. So it's definitely a reason why I'm very particular about special international players, like eligibility center, let's get this done. Let's make sure we're here, because I've seen like the other side of it as well. So
Well, that's interesting. Yeah, no, the mysteries of the NCAA. I mean, this is what we do, with players all day long. About 25% of our players that we bring in are internationals. Obviously, the Americans would never have an issue with, but internationals, it's part of what we have to do is advise them on how to fill out, the paperwork and to make sure that they're answering all their questions correctly, so that they don't run into these any of these issues. But we still can't figure out how, sometimes we get, not us necessarily, but we see players coming in that have had full professional Premier League playing experience and
yep.
are older, and they're getting cleared, and NCAA will not answer questions for you. We've asked,
Yeah,
how did this player get cleared? They'll say, well, each player is an individual. And we look at each one individually. That's all they'll ever tell you. And we can't figure it out. And then other players, like yourself, it's like, what did I do special to make me ineligible?
we had the conversation with our men's coach here the other day. I can't remember which team it was. But they signed a player who'd been on a preseason tour on a Premier League club, and they're being eligible as a freshman. And I'm going, I was playing in like the seventh tier in Scotland doing this and doing that, and I wasn't, you know. And it's kind of like, again, it is what it is, and it's the nature of it. And like you said, they take every case as it stands. But I'm like, you look at it from the outside looking in now as a coach, and you're like, wow, like how the game and how it's all developed recently, that someone that was literally like, I can Google them, and you know, they come on as a sub in their preseason games, and they're doing all this, and you're like, oh, you're eligible, but I was playing in a park where, you know, people were walking across it with their dog, not before it, but because I maybe played too many games at that level and then was dual registered, I wasn't able to play. You're like, okay, like this is where we're in right now. So, but it's definitely like you see that, and I'm like, I sent it to the men's coach and I was like, you're telling me this is happening right now? And but that's the nature of it. So
Yeah, it was wild. A number of years ago, I had a player play for me at a junior college, and when he transferred to an NAIA school, they docked him a year for what he had done. It was basically Sunday league football. It wasn't anything special. And yeah, it's so when American parents, wonder how this player got, you may be talking about the Ohio State player, because that was kind of a we actually made some posts about that young man. We're trying to figure out how he was eligible. And I think basically for a lot of it comes down to, how, yeah, they might be, you can go play professionally, you can go play for Manchester United, and if you're not on a, if you're not on a contract that pays you anything more than your necessary living expenses, you're still not considered a professional.
yeah.
So that's the way the NCAA looks at it. And we've had kids come in, they're paid basically $700 a month. It covers their gas back and forth. That's what it covers. They're not actually being paid to play and making, and that makes a difference. But yeah, it's interesting to hear different stories about players who are ineligible, and then other players that are eligible. And like I say, the mysteries of the NCAA.
It's, and again, I look back on it and I learn a lot from that experience. So again, if you put me in the spot, like at the time, it was like it wasn't great. But you know, as a player, like I was lucky enough, I say lucky enough, I had the COVID year as a fifth year, you know what I mean? So it's kind of like I got it back as such. But it's, you know, it's funny how things work.
So
And
they actually docked you a year.
yes, yep.
Wow, that's wild.
And again, I got no like clarification of like a bang bang, this is it. It was just kind of like a, yeah, we're waiting to see. And then it's like, well, can I redshirt then? They're like, no, because we don't actually know what the occasion would be. And then, you know, I transferred to a D3 school after my sophomore year, and the rules are always slightly different there, right? And it was kind of like they're looking through it and they're like, yeah, like no problem. Like, and then it's like, you know, I was nervous about the COVID year thing being, you know, with my how many semesters I had and stuff, whether I would actually even get it, you know.
Right.
So it was like when that got cleared and stuff, so okay, like phew. But you know, there's that little like a bit of anxiety about it being like, okay, like is this going to impact it going forward? But you know, it worked out the way it did, and the experience overall was fantastic, and yeah, loved it, absolutely loved it.
So what's it feel like this year having a big giant target on your back? Everybody wants to, I just know, I've been around long enough that everybody, boy, even if it's a t not even a rival, boy, we beat the national champions. How's that feel, and how are you preparing the girls, the women, to for the season coming up?
Yeah, I think like I think every target is earned, and it's about embracing that target. You know, if you think about it like as an actual target, like you're carrying it on your back, like it does exist, but are you going to stand up and embrace it, or are you going to kind of let it like crush you, you know? And we're hoping for to stand up and embrace it. I think last year we had a target on our back, or in terms of like the start of the year, you know, in conference especially, like everyone wanted to beat us. We were conference champs. Now every game we're going to play, you know, whether they post on social media or whether it's the announcer at the game, you know, it's so and so university playing reigning national champions Florida Tech. Like every game's now going to have that little piece to it. And I think it's a privilege and it's going to be an honor. But it's really going to be about embracing it. But I think again, we've done a good job with the group and how we kind of talk to them and how we communicate with them about the whole thing, that, you know, we're going to try and not make it be that thing, but we're also very much aware, and the girls are mature enough to know that like it does exist. And I think what's going to be a cool factor is our first game this coming fall will actually be against Franklin Pierce again. who we played in the national
Oh,
final.
wow.
So they're coming down to Melbourne. We played them up in up north during the fall, and it just so happened that that was the team that we're playing. So we're going to be playing them under the lights as our home opener. So again, that's going to be like a really cool environment, really cool experience. But yeah, we want to bring players in, and players that we have in the room, or they've got to embrace it. That's like the byproduct of being a successful team. You know, our job as coaches is to continue to grow and to bring in players that are going to challenge those that are in places just now, and then we move from there. But yeah, that's absolutely something that exists, but we want people to thrive in that environment rather than letting the environment maybe take over them. But I'm sure we'll have challenges with it. I'm sure there's, like you said, every team's now going to circle it. You know, I mean, we're going to be, we were probably already circled on a lot of teams, you know, schedules. Now it's going to be like the double circle is going to be around it. That's for sure. That's one way to put it. So yeah, excited. It's an honor, but we want to make sure we stand and hold that target firm, because every target achieved is an honor, you know? So let's embrace it, and let's go and move forward with it.
Yeah, it's when you guys are you guys done recruiting your class of 2026 now? Is it a completed class?
Feel like the recruiting piece is different at every level, compared to Division One, Division Two, NAIA, D3, JUCO. I think in terms of like everyone that's for 26, you know, we've got, I think we've got like five players signed. You know, they've signed their forms and everything, and they're good to go. You know, we've got a couple more players that we know exist and have, you know, maybe our verbal agreements. But then I think as a 26, like as a Division Two program, like you're always still keeping an eye out, because you never know like what could exist or what could come up, and maybe is there injuries in current rosters and stuff. So I think we've got like one eye on you know, potentially what could happen, but at the same time, knowing what we've got in the room and knowing who we've identified already, we would be happy with where we're at in that situation. So, and again, with the differences, recruiting timelines compared to, you know, whether it's players from Florida, whether it's players from Connecticut, or whether it's players from England, you know, there's different timelines, and we're comfortable in knowing kind of like when those players, you know, become available and stuff like that. So for, I would say we're aware of everyone that we could have on a roster 2026, but also if something was to come up, we probably have the ability to do a little bit more work and effort to move things around if needed to be. So, but I think we've identified kind of who we can have on our team, and we're very happy with that.
I love the way you put that, and because I try to explain this to people that really don't understand the process. Look, the best teams, the best coaches, the ones that are the most consistent, have exactly the attitude that your staff has. It's like, well, we could be done, but we're never really done. I mean, if the right player comes up, of course, we're going to figure out a way to do it. And it's there are these other teams and these other coaches that it's like, oh no, our class is complete. And they really mean it. Their class is done. And I then thinks, okay, come on. If the next superstar came along, you're telling me you really couldn't figure out a way to make a room? Now, at the Division One level, if you've got this 28 man roster limit, okay, it could be true. But even at that level, I find that the better coaches are they know something's going to come up. If an experienced coach has been around long enough, inevitably come March or April or could be even May, something pops up and you go, dang, I wish I had that roster spot still available. That player would have really helped us. And it's the ability to just stay calm as a coach and just know that, all right, we're good if we need to be good, but let's keep our eye open. Let's be sharp about it. And especially with the late transfer window now that does pop up in the NCAA, I think especially Division II schools, but mid-majors too, need to be prepared to be able to pivot.
Yeah, and I think going back to like the late point too. So we had a player transfer in from an NAI school, for my first fall, and she probably signed the dotted line at the end of June. She was one where she didn't know if she's going to have another year. Just kind of was waiting for the process to go through. We pick her up, and she was a third team, a second team all-region kid,
Wow.
scored probably 8 or 9 goals, good number of assists, and then she actually got another year of eligibility at the Division One level because she played NAIA. So she went and had a very successful at Middle Tennessee this past year. You know, so like those players exist, and sometimes that is a risk, you know. But I think it's about being able to get the balance right of being comfortable of who you've got in the room, and who, like I said, if we want it, if we can, if we're done and we're done, then we're good with that. But also knowing that, you know, we have the ability to do that. But it's also, like you said, the timing of that is also difficult because you don't know what's going to come up and how it can arise. So yeah, I think especially with like the culture of the portal opening later and things like that, like it can build to a little bit of like anxiety is not the right word, but it's that feeling of like, okay, do we want to commit or is the portal going to open and open up something else? But then also being able to take a step back and being comfortable and trusting in what we've seen and interacted with that player that yes, we'll be okay and kind of getting that piece right. And again, I think the coaches that have been successful and have had long careers are the ones that are the best in that ability to adapt and to suit the situation that's best for their team in that moment. So.
Oh, no doubt about it. I mean, I tell the story about a player that I had who, Mark Krikorian, when they had just won their first national championship at Florida State, found out about, and he was, he was with us and on campus in April. And the lesson to that for me was, if the best team in the country can figure out a way to make it work that late in the process, then coaches can figure out a way to make it work at some point. Which brings me to the advice that I always tell players and their parents when they're talking to me about, so coach said they're full. Does that mean they're really full? I said, well, it's their nice way of telling you you're not going to impact their team, in their opinion. They're just not going to make an impact because if, a national team player from, England suddenly popped up and said, I'm interested in this pathway. They would figure out a way to make it work. They would figure it out. They would tell somebody, you got a red shirt, or I'm gonna have to release you. They would figure out a way to make a roster spot for that player in some way. So I think that's for the parents and players listening to this podcast to hear it from you that you're kind of always still looking, you're kind of always still have an eye open or an ear to the ground just in case an impactful player comes open. And that's the other piece, Scott, is players don't understand a lot of, well, I'm just as good as this girl. Yeah, but that girl's not getting really much playing time. I know she's on the roster spot and she finagled away on the roster spot. But that's not their leading goal scorer, and that's not their starting goalkeeper, and that's not their starting center back, and that's not their captain. They need impactful players, as well as roster fillers.
Yeah, and I think to caveat all that too, like I think as an institution, like we're very well supported by our administration and helping and making those things work. You know, so I think it's also to appreciate and understand that the school were able to make things work. Like if someone was to come up, they're not pressuring us to be like, well, you must be XYZ number or you must have this timeline. Like they understand that the world of recruiting is always changing, you know. It has a domino effect. One player gets injured at one school, which then alters someone else's approach. And, you know, everything's like connected in some way that allows us to, you know, to be flexible in that process. And also knowing that, like, you know, different types of players are going to become available at different parts of the year and also kind of getting the lay of land with that, you know, especially with agencies sending players, you know, international players, like allowing, you know, finding out the timelines of when the professional clubs are releasing their players or they're told they're not getting their contracts, like knowing that that exists. And then also knowing the way that some agents operate, you know, you get the blast emails, but you also then get the emails where they're like, okay, well, I know the Norwegian, you know, professional academies sign in May. So it probably towards the end of April is going to be when those players become available. And that exists as well. And then also you could do the exact same thing with the Division One model too. You know, we see players that, you know, we talk to at events when they're, you know, just after June 15th and you see them play and you're like, you know, they tell you, I'm D1, I want this. And you're kind of like, okay, like that's great. But we also know the timeline of like when they probably realize that the Power Four Division One route isn't for them, you know? So I think knowing that again, and understanding as a coaching staff, like when the best time to kind of to follow players' pathways and go from that and fight that Division One or Division Two battle. And it's a battle that we probably fight every single day, but we embrace it and try and educate players. But I think knowing too, like the timelines and understanding that, you know, you've got to go and allow those players to experience that and to go and find what the right fit is for them. Because in their head, they think it's one thing. Chances are it's probably something slightly different. So I think seeing that and understanding that allows us to be successful in our recruiting model and things like that.
Yeah, what percentage of your team is international?
So this past fall, we were 14 in 14 US, 13 international. So as a percentage, it's just over
About half and half.
half for domestic. So I think in the past it had definitely been, probably 70-30 based on the international side. And I think when Katie and I came in, we wanted to increase our local base. Like we were going to camps and clubs, an hour and a half away, and some of them didn't even know what Florida Tech was. You know what I mean? So that was kind of like a spot for us to be like, okay, like we can go and do this. We can, make that impact. And we saw the benefits from it this fall. One of our freshmen, Izzy Bromage, was our second top goal scorer as a freshman. She was out of Massachusetts. So like knowing that there are good players in the US system that we can get to. We have our benefits as a school in terms of programs, in terms of location, in terms of conference. So like let's go and pick up these good players, because there are players that will look at D2. There are other players that won't look at D2. So that type of thing is important. I think if you look at our roster, every single player on our roster could play Division One. I think you mentioned it on the podcast with the AMSL head coach about the nine different tiers, and I couldn't agree more with that. Our best players on our team could absolutely go and be involved in Power Four teams, but then there's also players on our team that don't play that could go and play on that like lower mid-major D1 or next level D1 and be really, really good players on that standpoint. So again, just understanding the width of the D1 category, I think, is really important and something that we, as an institution and as a staff, like work really hard to get right. And I think more times than not, we do a really good job with that. So
Yeah, it is wild. And for those that didn't hear that podcast, I put a lot of thought into this. And I think Division One women's soccer is the most striated structure of any professional, any senior level structure in the world. I don't think it's more striated. You've got teams at the very bottom who, well, there was a team in the SWAC last year that couldn't even fill their roster. They had to forfeit their season. But they're competing at Division One, and you get all these kids that say, "I want to play Division One." They go, "Oh, but I wouldn't play there. I would never play there. I'd rather quit than play there." And there are a handful of teams in this country that fall into that category. And then as you work your way up, it goes from, teams that will never ever that will struggle to win 3 to 4 games every single year, and they have for the last 10 years. And then you'll have teams that will never win a conference title ever. That just is no way, not under the structure that they've had for the past 20 years. And then you work your way all the way up to we've got the same four or five teams winning a national championship at the Division One level year after year after year after year after year. And then you see the difference between that and Division Two, where we haven't, I was trying to think, when have we ever had a repeat back-to-back women's Division Two champion? I can't think of one.
I want to say maybe Grand Valley, probably 7 8 years ago, potentially. Pomona were close this year, won it 2024, Final Four this past year. But yeah, I think I remember listening to the podcast and being like thinking the exact same thing. Like the group of the Final Four, like you break it up into regions, and I think it makes for such a more competitive environment. And again, that's what players are looking for at times. Like I won't name the school, but I remember talking to a player who was between us and a Division One school, and you're kind of asking, and you're trying not to get in too deep with it, but you're also wanting to like scratch the surface. And she told me, yeah, like the preseason's longer at Division One. And I'm like, okay, it is longer. Like there's nothing you or I can do about that. But then I asked her, I was like, when did your team's season end? And she said, oh, I ended after Halloween. I'm like, well, we played till the middle of December. So we played almost 6 weeks, if not 7 weeks longer. Was your preseason 7 weeks longer than ours? It absolutely wasn't. And that's just another example of, and again, you can't blame the player. You know what I mean? It's what they've maybe been fed or what they've been told, and like that exists. But
That's
again,
what I think it is, Scott. I think it's that, and it's wild. One of the questions that I ask virtually every client, and even my recruiting when I was. Because I coached Division II in the CCAA out west, and we played Pomona and those schools when I was at Cal State East Bay, and I would use this in my recruiting talks with them too. But Would you rather, and is the game, and would you rather be on a Division One team that you'll be lucky to go 500, and that would be an amazing year if you went 500, or would you rather win a Division Two national championship or a Division Three national championship? And there's no right or wrong answer. It's the mentality of the player. But I was looking for, I was, as a coach, I'm always looking for a champion. And I was looking for a champion's mindset. And a champion wants to win championships, period. That's the drive, is to win things, as opposed to, I'm a part of, I might be on this team and I'm Division One, but I don't play much and we don't win much. But when I'm done at the end of the day, I was on a Division One team, and I kind of liken it. One of the analogies that I use is, a backpack or a belt or some fashion item. It says Gucci, or today, it's the Birkin bag. You can have a $56,000 purse, and my $12 backpack holds more stuff than your purse does, and is just as functional, if not more functional. And but if you have to have the status, if the status is what you're chasing, and again, with the pressures of social media these days, I can understand how people get sucked up into the status game. I can understand how that infects the mind and how it's really important. But I can't not be a coach, Scott. And as a coach, I have to roll my eyes. I've got to say, okay, then that's what you want. That's what you want. Move on. Because I'm looking for champions. I'm looking for players that want to win things, that are competitive, that have that competitive mindset, that won't stand for anything else but trying to be the best. Because that's how champions are made, period. There's no nice way of dancing around that game. And some kids just want to play D1. And then other kids. And the other thing is facilities. I mean, there are D1 schools in this country. I won't name them. There's a couple that come to mind. They don't have their own field. They play in a park.
Yep. And it's the, like you said, it's just the overall piece of it. And I think it also like attests to the character of the players that, that when we talk with players or players reach out, it's like, okay, like that want, that drive, that mature approach, like they see the whole picture, kind of like what you said, would you rather go 500 and be able to be done by October? Or do you want the drive? Do you want the drive to go and win something, to compete, to go and get something tangible? I think that, and again, there's no right or wrong answer, but it tells us a lot about probably your intrinsic thoughts and the way that you're built up, that like that's how you want to go and do things. And again, stress it that there's no right or wrong answer. Like if that's what people want to do, like that's okay. But from our standpoint, and I think like as a player, as a player's coach, like the relationship side of it's super important. Like when players are invested in us as a program, like that's great. Like when we get players, that reach out, especially like kind of transfer portal stuff, I think the D2 player that has been in all region or is a captain of their D2 play team and played a lot, and they come to us and they're like, hey, like I want to like step up my level and get to a better environment, we're going to look at that kid more so than the player that's played 130 minutes at a Division One school. Because again, where's the loss in, is some, where what's lost in translation here? Like we've got someone that is playing, they could be comfortable where they're at, but they're like, no, I want to go and drive and compete at the next level. I want to go and win things. That stands out to us a lot. And again, maybe that player that didn't play at the Division One school, like maybe they were just as good. That's the best thing about football and soccer is that it's a game of opinion, right? Like my opinion on a player might be your opinion on a player. Neither of us are right or neither of us may be wrong, but it's like your perception of how things go. But I think like when we're in that recruiting mindset and we're in that recruiting philosophy, like the D2 player to us, and we've had success from that, is going to stand out more. And again, you're a product of your environment and how you do things and your timelines and stuff. So like those are things that like that we notice. And then when we have players that, have that drive and that effort and kind of see like the overall picture, like that's a good a recipe for success for us as a coaching staff.
It's wild, and I'm not talking about 7-year-olds and 8-year-olds and 9-year-olds, and we're not talking about the importance of development at those ages. But when you get into senior level soccer, when senior level sports, right? Everything past high school, there, you winning matters. It matters, and that's why, one of the marks. So while we say neither one's right, neither one's wrong, it's a nice way of saying, look, we'll find out at the end of the day if I'm right. I'll know if I'm right because we win. If we don't win, then I didn't get it right, And if that player's not impacting our team, I didn't get it right. I didn't take the right player. And I'm not saying that that's an excuse to abandon that player and say that that player can't develop eventually and won't grow into something. That's not what I'm saying. But I am saying that I coached a kid named Jack Wainwright one time, and Jack wasn't a brilliant player. He wasn't. But if we played 2v2, he was on the winning team. If we played 5v5, he was on the winning team. If we played 7v7, he was on the winning team. And, he helped us, make it into the top 10 nationally. And he was one of our captains. The kid couldn't lose. No matter what game we played, if we were playing chess, he would win. If we were playing, Tiddlywinks, he would win. He figured out a way to win no matter what he did. He just wasn't going to lose. And there were games where I remember one game we were down 4-0 and he scores three of the four goals late in the game for us to come back and to win the game or tie the game, and he just couldn't lose. And those types of players just are so valuable to a team. They have a winning mindset and they can't stand losing. I always say there's two types of players: those that like to win and those that hate to lose. And I was a hate to lose guy. If we won, even as a coach and as a player though too, if we won, it was great. But I was thinking about how to win the next game. If we lost, I was miserable. I was a miserable person to be around. I hated that feeling of losing so much, and it was so painful that I would do everything in my power to figure out a way not to lose ever again.
Yeah,
It hurt
it's like
that
a habit
bad.
thing, right? Like winning can become a habit, and it becomes the norm. But when it's the same with life, right? When your habits get disturbed, that's when you find out like this is where it was. Because I was the same way as a player. Like lucky enough as a player to won a lot more than when we lost. But I can tell you every single game that we lost. I can tell you exactly like the way we lost it, how we lost it. Winning games, it goes either way. But even like as a coach now, like. The losses, granted, I think the losses were in the long run were good in terms of like it taught us a lot moments to react on, but I can tell you how we lost it because losing is not enjoyable. But I think again that it's the mindset and the overall approach to it, but also like we got something out of it. Do we win a national championship if we don't lose two games in a week in a conference? I don't know. And then you also go back to like the player standpoint where like you were using that example, like this kid just won. He did everything we did and he was important to the team. Might not have been the best player, in certain aspects. But are you guys successful without him? Probably not. And we had a good number of players like that this year when we've had meetings this spring of kind of like, our season went so long that finals ended. So we weren't able to have the end of season. We had the end of season meetings at the start of season, then filtered into the start of season meetings. So, and we had conversations with whether it was injured players or players that maybe didn't play that much. And it's like, hey, like we wouldn't have won without you. And they're kind of like, but I didn't play. And you're
Right.
like, the way you handled yourself, the way you committed to practice, the way you pushed those other players to be better, the way that you, when we're doing walkthroughs, the way that you interpreted the Cal Poly Pomona right over midfielder, like to help us learn how we wanted to do things, like all those little details. And it's like, they're almost the most important players because those are the ones that buy in and help the other players be successful. And granted, it's maybe not the role that they want or anticipate, but also like their humility and their ability to buy into that is so important. And like I said, we had a couple of meetings this past couple of weeks, and it's like, hey, like you might not have felt it because you weren't physically, on the field or you were injured, but like the work that you done did not go unnoticed. And if it wasn't for sacrifices you made or the ability or how you interacted in moments, we don't win without you. So I think those are the players that are so important to not just a team, but a culture, and you hope that those players have those progress stories to go and then go and do something, right? And to go and build it. So a quick tangent on that example is Caitlin Sinclair, our starting goalkeeper, who won the NCAA Mop Award, which I think needs to be rechanged because mop, you know, a mop.
Doesn't sound great.
Now, most outstanding player. So she won that for the NCAA tournament. She didn't play a lick her first 2 minutes here at Florida Tech. They had a good goalkeeper that came in. If you ask me if there was much between them, there wasn't. But seeing her growth and how bought in she was, you know, throughout her journey, she's now, you know, she was named last season, last 2024 was her first fall. She won goalkeeper of the year in her first season playing. Then this year she was NCAA tournament most valuable player at D2. You know, so people in that journey, you know, the team made it to the final four before I was here, and they're telling me how impactful Caitlin was in the final four, even though she hadn't played all year. And then she gets her opportunity and she goes and wins awards, and we don't win a national championship without her. You know, so like those are like really cool stories which we can use recruiting as well. You know, your role and the way your first year goes doesn't have to be every single year. We want to see growth, we want to see development. Yes, we want instant impact, but if instant impact isn't a thing, like how can you develop and kind of grow, and not just as a footballer, but as a person as well, is super important. So that's like a cool story that we have, and we've got multiple ones of those which we're really, really proud of as well.
I love it. You know what? That the way you wrapped this up is we're gonna end it right there, because that message that you're sending, you said something really important in there. It's not just about these are lessons that translate over to life later on, and how players handle themselves under the adversity. That winning mindset does transfer over to life. So I think anybody listening to this, if they just don't go back and listen to that last 5 minutes that Scott just gave us, because that is just gold right there. Hey, thanks for coming on, Scott. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem, Don. I appreciate it. I'm more than always happy to talk college soccer and Florida Tech and life. I'm sure you've gathered from this interaction that I can ramble and talk for a long period of time. And I think it's again, the personality
You're
stuff that
great.
I love talking about our program and how we've done things and how we're looking to continue to be great and things. So, and I appreciate your time with us. It's super enjoyable.
You were fantastic. I really appreciate it.
Perfect. Thank you, sir.
All right. Okay, everybody, talk to you soon.